Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. On Tuesday, November 5th, Columbus voters will decide the fates of two school issues. Issue 51, which would create the position of an independent auditor for Columbus City Schools, and Issue 50, a levy and bond issue that would generate more than $76 million a year, in part to pay for that new auditor, but also to expand classroom technology, improve teacher training, and this.
The goal is to be certain that all families with four-year-olds have access to affordable pre-kindergarten experiences. It doesn't necessarily mean the district will be the provider of those or the sponsor of those. What it does mean is that there'll be a task force, again, that establishes the standards for high-performing pre-kindergarten experiences.
That was Columbus Interim School Superintendent Dan Good speaking to WOSU's Mike Thompson on Columbus on the Record recently. Joining us now to flesh out what that experience might mean and what they're talking about is 89.7 NPR News reporter Tom Borgerding. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ann. Good to be here.
By the way, listeners, a five-part series on the levy proposals reported by Tom and Mandy Trimble airs this week. You can check out their work on our website as well at WOSU.org. So, Tom, have you figured out how a pre-K experience for all differs from universal pre-K as it applies to the levy? What do they mean?
Well, I haven't figured it out really. I went into this reporting assignment with a W. Shauna Gibbs quote from the July board meeting in mind. She says, "I think we are now in uncharted territory," and I think we're still in uncharted territory. This is an aspirational goal, as Mayor Coleman has said, to include all four-year-olds in high-performing pre-Ks. It's going to be expensive. The levy allows $8.5 million a year for this, but Interim Superintendent Good has said, you know, look, this is not going to be enough. They don't have enough room to bring all these 4,800 new four-year-olds in. That's how many he counts in the district that
currently do not
attend preschool. There's 4,800 students are four-year-olds. And so the aspiration is to give all these children a chance, but they have not figured out the nuts and bolts on how to do this. And when you ask them directly, they're vague about, you know, how they're going to do this. They're going to work with some private nonprofits. And a lot of the preschool classes, from what Superintendent Good says, will be requests for proposals. So it'll be a competitive scenario where maybe a nonprofit or a private group wants to provide pre-K education, and the board will look at these requests for proposals and determine whether or not they meet some standard.
Which has not been established yet.
That's right. Some standard that's not been established yet.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest right now, 89.7 NPR News reporter Tom Borgerding. He's been working on a series this week with his colleague Mandy Trimble. If you recognize his voice, that is, you can go to our website at WOSU.org and check out the series in your own time. So when they talk about the 8.5 moving out into time to 2020, does that mean that people who otherwise could have sent their kids to pre-K will now be getting it through the school district somehow? Or is there going to be an income? Is there going to be means testing for this kind of a thing?
No, they want every child in the district to possibly attend preschool or pre-K education. And the reason for this is, I mean, the thrust of this whole Columbus Education Commission, it's a building block of sorts. In other words, if they can get four-year-olds ready for kindergarten, they think that down the road, academic achievement scores will actually improve in second grade, third grade, fourth grade, fifth grade. So, you know, as I said, Mayor Coleman says this is an aspirational goal. They haven't figured out how to pay for it all yet. But they really want to get these four-year-olds into school so that down the road they'll maybe have the vocabulary and the reading skills that they need to compete.
And to achieve the other larger goals that they have for the district, which is to make every school building in the district
high-performing school. You can't do that if half of the children are not reading at grade level. I visited Mays Elementary School as part of this story, and they have three special needs pre-K classes there. They've got a new principal, Nikki Henry, is there, and she says, you know, they've already begun to schedule intervention periods almost daily for children who are identified as maybe not reading up to grade level. So they have this thrust, if you will, to really improve the reading scores. They think that's really a basic building block of getting these schools back up to academic achievement levels.
Reading skills, but pre-K isn't necessarily about reading.
No, but it's about shapes and maybe counting a little bit and colors. I mean, but if they're not ready for kindergarten, you start behind the curve, according to the superintendent, and the educators will say, look, if you do remedial kindergarten, if that's a word, they're not ready for first grade or second grade because they're continually trying to, gain on other students.
There are not enough existing slots in pre-K, probably what would we consider viable pre-K programs, the kind that they're talking about here. There simply aren't enough slots even available in Columbus right now.
That's right. The district has 44 preschool classes, 44 preschools that...
The district runs.
Right, the district runs. According to Good, about 89% of those students test ready for kindergarten. So he thinks that's, actually it is better. Two-thirds of students who don't go to preschool test ready for kindergarten. So that's a difference between 89%, almost 90% of kids who attend pre-K are ready for kindergarten. Two-thirds of the students that don't go through schools are not ready. So that's only about 33%. So there's a big gap in readiness that they already know of. And so that's why they're aspiring to send all these four-year-olds to school. But they don't have enough money, and they don't have enough building space.
Okay, and they don't have the standards yet for outside the buildings.
That's right. They do not have the standards. So Good tells me that, they're gonna spend some of this money, obviously, on salaries because they're going to have to hire more preschool teachers. They're going to spend it on curriculum materials, on training, and then try to partner with these private nonprofits in these requests for proposals to kind of leverage that money to provide the pre-K for.
Do we know what they mean by private nonprofits? Are they talking about Montessori schools? Are they talking about these already existing nice pre-K schools that are out there? Or are they talking about just a daycare center that they're going to spiff up and give some training to and that sort of thing?
Well, Good says that, the teachers in these schools will be certificated. So it won't be a glorified babysitting preschool. In terms of the competition from the private sector, I don't know this. Could be a 501(c) that has a mission for education.
But they have to be private nonprofits.
That's in the, I think that's in the language, yes. So.
Okay. About a week ago, 10 days ago, the school board reported that it had underestimated tax revenue.
Yes.
And actually had a surplus rather than a deficit that had been reported 10 days before that. But the district's treasurer is saying that it doesn't make a difference for the levy. So could it make a difference for anything as far as could maybe they ramp up their pre-K hopes and dreams?
I think with general operating funds, they're free to spend them. However, this is not something that the levy backers and the reformers would indicate that it has anything to do with the levy. But obviously, in a voter's mind, I think it was $70 million that was a difference that possibly could make a difference.
the pre-K component of the levy proposal is something that a lot of people are excited about. They're very enthused about it. And also, a lot of people are very skeptical about.
Jonathan Beard, especially, he is the head of an anti-levy group. And at a forum in Clintonville about a week and a half ago, he said, look, he said, we can't do K through 12 just yet because of so many schools that have D or F ratings. He said, we ought to do those first rather than expand another 4,800 students into the district. So, yeah, there's a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot, but there is some skepticism that, you know, this should be done.
I want to bring into the conversation now Lori Katz. She teaches early childhood education at Ohio State University. Welcome to the show, Lori.
Thank you.
I mentioned so many people feel so passionately about expanding pre-K access. They're the skeptics. I don't think Jonathan Beard necessarily is against pre-K. He's just saying it's not pragmatic. It's not the approach he would take. Everybody seems to think pre-K is important these days, but for maybe different reasons.
It's essential. In the 80s, Robert Fulcrum wrote a book, said, "Everything you wanted to know, I learned in kindergarten." I think we can say that now for pre-K. Everything that I learn in pre-K.
They talk about that third grade reading guarantee, that they need to know to read by the third grade so that they can use reading to learn beyond the third grade. So pre-K then is that stuff. It doesn't necessarily teach you to read, but it teaches you how to learn so you can learn to read?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We do so much in pre-K. First of all, we look at the whole child, and we take the child where they're what they've already learned, and we're promoting their cognitive development, socio-emotional development, sensory motor. They are, when they come to kindergarten, and there these kind of studies that have been done in the early 60s in terms of looking at the impact of pre-K has just been unbelievable. And those studies keep getting replicated all
the time.
Meaning
there is an impact over
time. Oh, yes. Absolutely.
Because there's been other more recent studies that question whether the IQ really changes and that sort of thing. But
right.
There are other studies that show over time, the big longitudinal studies from the 60s that
absolutely.
Say that they tend to be more successful in life. Right. They stay in school longer. They are more successful, they're better family members.
They're going to have less, they probably will not be in special education, or if they're in special education, they wouldn't be as long, and that's what we have found in studies. They're not going to be retained like they have
and
been.
And all these are expenses.
These are all expenses. So you really have to look at yes, it is expensive to start a program, but the impact along the line is, that you'll find later on, and that we found through the Perry Preschool longitudinal study is the impact is it's so much benefit in terms of cost. Benefit of cost in terms of the society, school districts, how much money that they do spend. You're going to find people who have had preschool are more apt to finish high school, go on to higher level paying jobs than people who don't have it. So this argument about that we have issue, we've got to deal with what's happening in elementary school and all the problems in elementary, junior high school is not the argument really here. The argument is that a less of those problems would be occurring if we had good, high-quality preschool programs.
That's Lori Katz. She teaches early childhood education at Ohio State University. She'll stay with us. Tom Borgerding, thanks for talking about what's in the issue and what's at stake here.
Well, we'll try to keep this going up until obviously Election Day.
November 5th.
Well, it's a very big topic of discussion in the community.
All right. Well, thanks, Tom, for joining us.
Thank you, Ann.
Coming up, we'll hear from an economist about the cost-benefit analysis of the pre-K approach to education. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the cost-benefit analysis of pre-kindergarten education, or pre-K, something that's called for by the group behind Issues 50 and 51 on the November ballot. Issue 51 would create the position of an independent auditor, and Issue 50, a levy and bond issue that would generate more than $76 million a year, in part to pay for that new auditor, would also expand classroom technology, improve teacher training, and, among other things, devote $1 million or $8.5 million per year for pre-K. Still with us, Lori Katz, who teaches early childhood education at Ohio State University. Joining us now is Maria Fitzpatrick. She teaches at Cornell University. She teaches policy and management at Cornell University and is a visiting scholar at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Maria, what are some of the complications in the push for universal pre-K? That's something that the president has called for at the national level, something that the governors, the National Governors Association has pushed for as well. Why? How do we measure the financial gains and the financial losses of it?
Compare the costs and benefits of any educational intervention. The costs are usually monetized by the sort of short-term cost. So in the example of preschool, it would be the direct cost of providing the preschool. That's going to include things like the cost of the teachers and the space and, all the other sorts of things that come with providing schooling to four-year-olds. The benefits are a little bit more complicated because it turns out that what we've seen is that preschool has both short-term and longer-term benefits across a number of dimensions. And some of those dimensions are more difficult to measure than others, and longer-term benefits are more difficult to measure than shorter-term benefits because, of course, you have to wait in order to observe the longer-term benefits. So in the short term, what I mean is that children participating in preschool, we can look at things like their test scores or their social-emotional function, soon after they've completed the preschool year or years. And we can look at things like your other guest mentioned, so things like grade retention and also, academic achievement and other sorts of academic and social-emotional outcomes even as children progress through school. And then we can also think about how this might have longer-term benefits for children. We have seen longer-term benefits for preschool, for high-quality preschool interventions on things like wages, employment, decreases in criminal activity, improvements in health, those sorts of things. And so, economists and other researchers go about trying to monetize the value of all of those benefits to society and compare the sum of those both short-term and long-term benefits to the cost of providing the particular preschool intervention that took place.
In the research that's been done, is there any standardization when we're talking about what is high-quality preschool intervention? And you mentioned the year or years that a child might be in preschool. Is there any part of the equation that addresses whether the kid's in for 3 years or for just that first year before kindergarten starts? Does it matter?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that we have what I would say is initial evidence on these questions, but there's certainly not the same sort of large body of evidence that we have about the more general question of, do high-quality interventions, generally speaking, have positive long-term effects. As far as the questions about duration or specific characteristics, you know, we have some evidence that more time in preschool might be better, particularly when it comes to academic outcomes, but that the returns are diminishing, so that, you know, the second year spent in preschool doesn't have as big a positive effect as the first year spent in preschool. But like I said, you know, there hasn't been the bulk of studies that have confirmed that in different settings that we'd like to see before we, you know, we're certain of those results. Similarly, you know, we've seen a number of what we would call intensive preschool interventions. So things like the very famous Perry Preschool study or Abecedarian study, you know, that involved lots of sort of inputs. The children were in high-quality preschool arrangements with well-trained teachers. The children oftentimes also received other things like parental visits at their home that helped their parents learn more about, you know, high-quality developmental interactions with their children and taught parents about things like health, the importance of health and nutrition and those sorts of things. So we have some indication that there are certain components that might be valuable. For example, like we know that the quality of interactions between children and their caregivers is of the utmost importance, but we don't have great ways to measure that without, you know, or to know what the quality of those interactions are without observing teachers and children, and that's a pretty expensive enterprise. So we're still trying to suss out how exactly to measure quality. The Obama's initiative and many states with preschool programs have measured quality in terms of teachers' credentialing or teachers' education, things like class size, all of which we guess has some effect, but the literature on the size of these effects is somewhat thin.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about pre-K. It's a proposal that'll be on the ballot on November 5th in Columbus. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Lori Katz, what about the more is more or it doesn't really matter issue when we talk about, would 3 years of pre-kindergarten be the ideal or not necessarily?
It's, you can't just kind of look at the number of years.
The length isn't
the length.
As critical.
Yeah,
okay.
Right. I mean, one of the things that was done in the 1970s is that we looked at, in the 60s, where there were the Perry Preschool, mm-hmm. the Abecedarian, and those programs, and we looked across all of those. There was actually a meta-analysis that was done of all those programs. And they did say that you want to have children have learning experiences to start as early as possible. And then they're looking at as few children per teacher as possible. I think what the economist Maria was saying before about the families is that in terms of a good high quality preschool, you have to involve families into that child's education. So that's really critical, whether it be home visits or however you're going to do that.
And that's any kind of preschool.
That's any kind of preschool.
For any kind of socioeconomic cutaway we could be
right.
talking about.
Which, you know, it's interesting. If you speak with the kindergarten teacher, they can pick out those kids that haven't had a pre-K experience. And where that really is critical are your children from low socioeconomic backgrounds and your dual language learners.
Why is that?
Because they haven't learned how to do school and they haven't been exposed to the type of teaching that really promotes cognitive development. When we talk about reading, we're really looking at promoting in pre-K literacy experiences, which is a wide variety. It's just obviously not reading. It's not, you know, reading per se, on this.
It's knowing the difference between an apple and an orange and being able to talk about the weather.
No, it's really helping kids to problem solve, to learn how to think about the world around them. That is so critical that you really need in order to take those skills into literacy, math. And we have shown through studies that we can, that we do that by having very much more of a play-based, center-based environment where kids are able to explore. And we find that kids can, in terms of their social emotional development, they really learn how to get along with not only their teachers, but their peers, how to sit down.
So they can learn.
They learn. Yes, exactly.
So they can learn.
Yes.
Maria Fitzpatrick, one alternative to universal pre-K is something called targeted pre-K. Can you talk about that and if there's some analysis of that out there now that that might be another way or another option?
Yeah, so most of what the evidence that we have about how important high-quality pre-K environments can be for children comes actually from studies that were done where the participants were lower income, were from lower income families. And it's very clear throughout a wide body of evidence that in those types of high quality interventions for kids from disadvantaged families, there are large benefits to be reaped from these interventions. What's less certain is how effective large-scale government intervention will be for more advantaged families, so for those from the middle and upper income levels. There's some evidence that we're getting from universal preschool programs that have been introduced in recent memory, so in Georgia and Oklahoma and Florida and some other states, they've introduced broadly available universal preschool programs that are available to families regardless of income. Mm-hmm. It's worth pointing out that they're not only available regardless of income, they're subsidized by the fully subsidized by the government regardless of income. It's worth pointing out that that's not actually what Obama has proposed. What he's proposed is making preschool for all available regardless of income, but he's his plan only fully subsidizes the price of that preschool for children whose families are up to 200% of the poverty level. So for a family of four, that would be those living under who have less than $50,000 worth of income. And above that, there'll be some sort of sliding. There'll likely be some sort of sliding scale for the cost depending on family income.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that's kind of important because what we've seen for most of the universal preschool interventions is that it still is the low-income kids that benefit the most. It's still the kids that without the government's intervention, without some sort of subsidy enticing them to participate in preschool, they wouldn't participate in any sort of preschool or childcare environment. And it, you know, for those families, getting that type of participation is really valuable.
Yeah, I want to agree with Maria. I think it's low income, absolutely. And I would also add dual language learners. You're hearing a lot about Hispanic families not being able to access and really having difficulty when they do reach kindergarten. There's really a quite learning about school is so critical in the pre-K. The other thing I want to add is we are just so behind in terms of the world. I was in South Korea last year. They have universal pre-K. They don't charge at all for anybody.
In other words, it's paid for by the public,
yes.
But it's part of the system.
It's part of the system. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a real attitude here that... You know, that pre-K is going, you know, we're not going to invest the money because we can't find that pre-K is going to be the fix to really, you know, to look at down the road. And you found that also in your Head Start studies, that yes, you need, you know, Head Start is very effective, but the scores decrease in, you know, by the time they're second, third grade. And you really need to keep, you know, that's why you had the follow-through program, because you need to keep developing, because you know, the question is, are you really even, you know, is that really socially constructed? Can you have all kindergartners, you know, who are all at the same level? You know, of course not. You know, when you look at now a typical kindergarten, you're going to see kids at four different developmental
They could
levels.
All be from the same socioeconomic level. It's not about that.
No, right. Not at all. It's about
in any given class.
No, yeah.
It's developmental.
And it's also, it's interesting in terms of kindergarten is, well, when do kids actually start kindergarten? And that really varies across districts. Well, you know, one district may say, well, they have to be five by December 1st. Somebody else will say maybe, you know, September 1st. And they seem to want to kind of push the age, you know, to get them older before they even start kindergarten. And then there's been issues about kids, if a teacher, you know, when they get screened for kindergarten for any, and usually the screening is for any developmental delays, any further special education referrals. And sometimes I've seen teachers say, maybe that child should just stay home for another year, you know, and let them develop. Let them mature. And I think that kind of attitude sometimes is what our families or our society has. Just give them a little extra year, you know, to grow. Now, I want to say that comes from maybe a teacher who really doesn't know the importance, you know, of early childhood education that says that.
We are talking about early childhood education, pre-K. It is an option on if you are going to vote on November 5th in Columbus. There's issues 50 and 51, and one of those issues creates the job of an internal auditor for the city school district, and another creates a funding stream for that and other things, including what is hoped for will be something like universal pre-K in the Columbus City School District by 2020. If you have a question or comment for our experts, Lori Katz of The Ohio State University and also Maria Fitzpatrick at Cornell University, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the cost-benefit analysis of pre-kindergarten education, or pre-K, something that's called for by the group behind Issues 50 and 51 on the November ballot in Columbus. Issue 51 would create the position of an independent auditor, but Issue 50 would pay for that and many other things, including devoting $1 million or $8.5 million a year for pre-K. The idea is to eventually get all the 4,500 kids who are in that age group into a pre-K program by 2020. Still with us, Lori Katz, Associate Professor of Early Childhood Education at Ohio State, and also Maria Fitzpatrick. She's an Assistant Professor at Cornell University and Visiting Scholar at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Once again, questions or comments, 614-292-8513. or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Maria, maybe you can take a swipe at this. It's a Facebook message from Sheila. She writes, can you comment on some reports from the UK suggesting a focus on informal play-based pre-K education and delaying formal education until age 6 or 7? Their findings suggest that delaying formal education improves attitudes toward literacy, especially for disadvantaged groups. Is there a difference in the cost-benefit analysis when you look at that kind of pre-K experience versus one that's more structured, more focused on literacy and that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, Lori might know a little bit more about the different types of programs and how they affect development, but I would imagine that under both situations, what you really need are well-trained teachers, so teachers that are able to engage students in the type of instruction, structured instruction, or less structured play that will help them, more fully develop their cognitive and non-cognitive and socio-emotional skills. And so I would imagine that the cost-benefit analysis would be pretty similar in terms of how you would do it. I'm not aware of the particular research, so I don't know about, you know, whether the types of benefits that they're seeing from these programs in the UK are larger than the types of benefits that are seen from the interventions that we've had here in the U.S., but perhaps Lori does.
Yeah, I could add to that. First of all, the UK has a great program. Their informal education is very much like our play-based program right now. And I think what's really important, we have found in the research, there's not just one program, one curriculum that is going to, you know, really get kids in terms of the scores. And that's been done. There's been a lot of those studies were first done in the 60s. You are doing those studies now. There's a big study in Tennessee that's looking at, again, the type of curriculum. So it's not one study. It's really not one curriculum. You do need a good, I think, play-based, cognitively oriented curriculum. What's more important, I think, in terms of what's not good that we're seeing out there, unfortunately, is the prescriptive kind of program that is coming down to pre-K. For instance, you're seeing where a teacher will stand and give the child, it'll be more lecture, give the child
more like first
directions,
grade.
More like first grade. They're doing worksheets. I mean, they're not ready, and that's unethical, quite honestly, to have even worksheets in a pre-K. So those kinds, that's really not what we would even call a good curriculum, you know, to have, you know, worksheets.
So you know, pretty like critical that. Then in this process, if this issue were to pass, they don't even know what the standards are going to be for pre-K. And that's going to be pretty critical
I do want to be careful about that, that I've been involved in. Ohio really has some very good early learning standards that they have put together for birth through kindergarten.
So they could kind of glom onto what's already out there then in Ohio.
Absolutely, yes. Okay. Ohio's doing a great job in putting those out, and we're now working on the implementation guide. I'm actually developing professional development for preschool teachers or for dual language learners and to really prepare teachers to how to use the standards and as well as principles that we have put together. So we're, you know, that's being done right now. And I think that's very exciting. I think the standards are good standards. They're also attached to the kindergarten, you know, on up standards. So there's a really nice connection going on between the pre-K and the early elementary standards. I think there's more of a connection being made in that area.
Maria Fitzpatrick, I know you have to take off in a few minutes. We've been talking about who has the most to gain. It seems obvious that kids who stand to gain the most from pre-K are the ones who come from poor or less educated or immigrant or dual language backgrounds. Has this been monetized in any way? In other words, can we just focus on them and then them we could maybe afford? Or is it too hard to sift them out at this point?
Yeah, well, so it's the gains have been monetized and compared to the costs, particularly for the research that has done that has been particularly valuable. That's come out of the studies done in the early 60s and 70s. That's because those studies were high quality, but it's also because we've been able to follow the participants long enough to know what the longer term life benefits are. And across those studies, what we're seeing is returns as high as, you know, $3 to $7 for every dollar that's invested. So that's if we add up those gains in wages and reduced crime and health benefits and all those sorts of things. But as we talked about, those participants were relatively low income, and it's not clear that the benefits, you can't just extrapolate the benefits for the low-income kids to those from more advantaged families, because people in more advantaged families are participating, or oftentimes participating, in high-quality preschool environments, even if the government isn't subsidizing that. So we do, in fact, probably face a choice of, we have limited resources. That's probably obvious to everyone in this, current economic climate. And there's likely to be a choice whether we provide universal preschool and subsidized preschool for everyone and are able to spend a relatively low, small amount of money on each four-year-old, or whether we, provide a much richer environment for a smaller subset of kids, like the more disadvantaged kids and English language learners that are known to have the most benefit from these programs. And, that's a trade-off that we're going to have to try to figure out, but there are still some unanswered questions. For example, we don't know how beneficial it is for low-income four-year-olds to participate in preschool environments where they get exposure to students that are, perhaps a little bit, on average, more prepared for school than they are, whether there's, benefits from that type of socialization before they get to kindergarten or not. We still don't quite have the answer to that. So there are some unanswered questions, but certainly we do face a trade-off between spending more money on a subset of kids versus less money on all kids.
Well, Maria Fitzpatrick, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thanks for having me.
You bet. Bye-bye. Maria Fitzpatrick, she teaches policy and management at Cornell University and is a visiting scholar at the National Bureau of Economic Research. Still with us is Lori Katz. She teaches early childhood education at Ohio State University. Why don't we get to some calls now? Norma in Hilliard, you're on the air. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on. I like the way she was talking about trade-offs just there, because I was a stay-at-home mom and took care of my children, and they were quite ready for school. I'm a college-educated person. I'm one of those people who has the ability to give the kids what they needed and whatnot. I'm a grandma now, so I'm helping my grandchildren and putting into that. And I've always philosophically felt that it's good for children not to have to be institutionalized. I saw them in the daycares in France being institutionalized from, mothers had to work. And so as soon as you got off your maternity leave, you dropped your kid off at the daycare. And they had them, like, for the rest of their growing up. And I didn't like that system. And I liked, having more time to put into my children and that degree of being, I'm not homeschooling perhaps, but really being involved in my kids. And if you've got a universalized preschool type thing, you're going to be encouraging people more and more toward, downgrading the impact of the stay-at-home mom or the value of the stay-at-home mom, which is already kind of threatened. And I also feel that as far as trade-offs, another trade-off that we don't consider, there are parents who need parenting classes. And there are mothers who work who really could do a lot better job with their children and preparing them if they had, you know, but they don't have the economic support. You know, they're taking, I've seen women, you know, they're working night shift. Mm-hmm. So when are they going to be with their kids? You know, she works night shift, mm-hmm. dad's home on day on, you know, he works, so he's home during the day with the kids and you know, well, you know, it's just,
well,
these people,
I mean,
with these horrible
somebody's
schedules,
home with the kids.
Yeah, but
it's,
I mean,
better than nothing.
You can have some people home, but the whole shift in people coming and going and in the economic difficulties that a lot of our underprivileged families have, I don't know that there's been just since we got our new governor in here. Well, he's not new anymore, but I mean, there has been a major cutback in funding for pre-K
for Head Start.
You know,
right.
Yeah, they got rid of the ELI program and cut back, you know, that support that a lot of working moms were depending on, and okay. a lot of people who just needed kind of help out with that on the low income scale.
Well, let's hear what Norma. Thank you so much for your call. Let's hear what
okay,
Lori Katz has to say. Yeah, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, I'll be off the line. Thank
All
you
right,
very much.
Thank you, Norma.
Thank you for this conversation.
You bet.
Yeah, I think. I mean, it's. I think Norma is somebody whose child didn't need preschool. And she did have that opportunity, which was really great, to really kind of stay home and give her child the type of experiences that, you know, they needed.
But there's other stay-home people who aren't necessarily as well equipped. Norma sounded incredibly articulate and knew about what she knew about.
Right, right.
Just because you can afford to stay home doesn't make you a Norma.
No, not at all.
Norma sounded great.
And, I mean, I want to say absolutely that I think pre-K can only do good for everybody. You know, in terms of looking at the impact, we do know that the impact is better for kids from low socioeconomic levels and dual language learners. But I think what Norma brings up is a bigger issue. Here is, first of all, I don't think it's about, I think people who still want to be at home will still, and school their children will still do it, even with the universal preschool. I do think we need to look at the larger issue that there are more mothers out there that need to work. They need to work, and because of that, they need high quality pre-K programs. I mean, you know, and mothers, unfortunately, cannot always work because they can't get the type of high-quality program that they want, or they find it's really so expensive, it's not going to help me. Now, and we all know that we need to strengthen the family. If we, you know, one way to work with the child is to strengthen the family. And that's another reason why you need a high-quality pre-K.
Because a high-quality pre-K incorporates the family.
Exactly.
That's a big component of it.
Yes, exactly.
Charlie in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Charlie.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Fine, thank you.
Great. I'm a Clintonville resident, so that by definition, I'm all for education. I've been seeing signs pop up, vote no on 5051. And, you know, nobody knows what it is. They think it's hire some administrator to do something, and wrapped inside of that all is this pre-K initiative. So, you know, if you do the numbers, 8.5 million into 4,500 kids, it's only 1,888 per kid.
Yeah, it ain't happening. They say by 2020 is what they're shooting for, but
okay.
At that amount of money, it still wouldn't be happening.
Uh-huh. How about the way we don't even know that it is, in fact, tied to the pre-K? I mean, when you look at 5051, it looks like another administrator to handle a bunch of initiatives. It's not really highlighted as a pre-K learning initiative.
Well, I can't answer the question for them, but I can say that what they say is that it will be something they will shoot for.
Mm-hmm.
To use a really colloquial term. I mean, it's something they're going to shoot for. They're shooting for it. I'm going to the what I have here on early childhood. They say what we know, children who come to school ready are significantly more likely to succeed academically, but in Columbus, more than a third enter kindergarten unprepared. Our mission, we will give children every chance to succeed by providing affordable pre-K education that will put them on the right path in life. By 2015, most children living in the Columbus City School District should have a high-quality pre-K experience. By 2020, this should be true for all children. The question is, what does that mean? How will that be achieved? And that sort of thing. So, Charlie, it's a good question. I mean, they've said that they don't anticipate that it will occur in the district. Mm-hmm. I think they said we learned earlier there are 44 pre-K classrooms in the district now. So we don't know if some of that will be expanded, but they are also looking at public-private. So that's all we know, Charlie, but we'll keep working on it.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your work, guys.
Yeah, thank you for your call. We appreciate it. Well, Lori Katz, we're basically out of time. I want to thank you for joining us today. Maybe come back again, and we can continue to scratch our way through this.
Right. The other thing I just want to, before I leave, to really put a plug here, is that in pre-K, we can identify kids who have maybe some delays
and you can
earlier,
do it sooner.
And we can do it sooner. And we know the importance of early intervention. We know if we can do it sooner, then that child has a much better way to really meet their academic potential.
Okay. Once again, thank you. It's Lori Katz. Thanks to the Allside staff this week. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Kiram Shaban, Julia Hyder, Andrew Zissler, and Leticia Wiggins. Thanks for listening. This is Allsides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of Ohio State University.